He was king of Pagford, the old man was saying, oblivious to the wooden expression on the shopkeeper's face. I liked Barry Fairbrother. Tragedy, that was, tragedy. The Mollison boy did our wills, and I thought he was very pleased with himself. Miles had lost his nerve at that and had slipped back out of the shop, his face glowing like a schoolboy's. He wondered whether the well-spoken old man was the originator of that anonymous letter. Miles's comfortable belief in his own likability was shaken, and he kept trying to imagine how it would feel if nobody voted for him the following day. As he undressed for bed that night, he watched his silent wife's reflection in the dressing-table mirror. For days, Samantha had been nothing but sarcastic if he mentioned the election. He could have done with some support, some comfort, this evening. He also felt randy. It had been a long time. Thinking back, he supposed that it had been the night before Barry Fairbrother dropped dead. She had been a little bit drunk. It often took a little bit of drink these days. "How was work?" he asked, watching her undo her bra strap in the mirror. Samantha did not answer immediately. She rubbed the deep red grooves in the flesh beneath her arms left by the tight strap, then said, without looking at Miles, "I've been meaning to talk to you about that, actually." She hated having to say it. She had been trying to avoid doing so for several weeks. "Roy thinks I ought to close the shop. It's not doing well." Exactly how badly the shop was doing would be a shock to Miles. It had been a shock to her when her accountant had laid out the position in the baldest terms. She had both known and not known. It was strange how your brain could know what your heart refused to accept. "Oh," said Miles. "But you'd keep the website?"
"Yeah," she said. "We'd keep the website."
"Well, that's good," said Miles encouragingly. He waited for almost a minute out of respect for the death of her shop. Then he said, "I don't suppose you saw the Gazette today." She reached over for the nightdress on her pillow, and he had a satisfying glimpse of her breasts. Sex would definitely help relax him. "It's a real shame, Sam," he said, crawling across the bed behind her and waiting to put his arms around her as she wriggled into the nightdress, "about the shop. It was a great little place, and you've had it, what, 10 years?
14, said Samantha. She knew what he wanted.
She considered telling him to go and screw himself and decamping to the spare room, but the trouble was that there would then be a row and an atmosphere, and what she wanted more than anything in the world was to be able to head off to London with Libby in 2 days' time, wearing the T-shirt that she had bought them both, and to be within close proximity of Jake and his bandmates for a whole evening. This excursion constituted the entire sum of Samantha's current happiness. What was more, sex might assuage Miles's continuing annoyance that she was missing Howard's birthday party. So she let him embrace and then kiss her. She closed her eyes, climbed on top of him, and imagined herself riding Jake on a deserted white beach, 19 years old, to his 21. She came while imagining Miles watching them furiously through binoculars from a distant pedalo. 10. At 9 o'clock on the morning of the election for Barry's seat, Parminder left the old vicarage and walked up Church Row to the Walls' house. She rapped on the door and waited until, at last, Colin appeared. There were shadows around his bloodshot eyes and beneath his cheekbones. His skin seemed to have thinned and his clothes grown too big. He had not yet returned to work. The news that Parminder had screamed confidential medical information about Howard in public had set back his tentative recovery. The more robust Colin of a few nights ago, who had sat on the leather pouf and pretended to be confident of victory, might never have been. "Is everything all right?" he asked, closing the door behind her, looking wary.
"Yes, fine," she said.
"I thought you might like to walk down the church hall with me to vote." "No," he said weakly. "I'm sorry." "I know how you feel, Colin," said Parminder, in a small, tight voice. But if you don't vote, it means they've won. I'm not going to let them win. I'm going to go down there and vote for you, and I want you to come with me. Parminda was effectively suspended from work. The Mollisons had complained to every professional body for which they could find an address, and Dr. Crawford had advised Parminda to take time off. To her great surprise, she felt strangely liberated. But Colin was shaking his head. She thought she saw tears in his eyes. I can't, Minda.
You can, she said. You can, Colin. You've got to stand up to them. Think of Barry.
I can't. I'm sorry. He made a choking noise and burst into tears. Colin had cried in her surgery before now, sobbed in desperation at the burden of fear he carried with him every day of his life. Come on, she said, unembarrassed, and she took his arm and steered him through to the kitchen, where she handed him kitchen roll and let him sob himself into hiccups again.
Where's Tessa?
At work, he gasped, mopping his eyes. There was an invitation to Howard Mollison's 65th birthday party lying on the kitchen table. Somebody had torn it neatly in two. I got one of those as well, said Parminda, before I shouted at him. Listen, Colin, voting,
I can't,
whispered Colin, shows them they haven't beaten us.
But they have, said Colin.
Parminda burst out laughing. After contemplating her with his mouth open for a moment, Colin started to laugh too, a big, booming guffaw, like the bark of a mastiff.
All right, they've run us out of our jobs, said Parminda, and neither of us wants to leave the house, but other than that, I think we're in very good shape indeed.
Colin took off his glasses and dabbed his wet eyes, grinning.
Come on, Colin, I want to vote for you. It isn't over yet. After I blew my top and told Howard Mollison he was no better than a junkie in front of the whole council and the local press,
he burst out laughing again, and she was delighted. She had not heard him laugh so much since New Year, and then it had been Barry making him do it.
They forgot to vote on forcing the drug clinic out of Bellchapel, so please get your coat. We'll walk down there together.
Colin's snorts and giggles died away. He stared down as the big hands fumbled over each other, as if he were washing them clean.
Colin, it's not over. You've made a difference. People don't like the Mollisons. If you get in, we'd be in a much stronger position to fight. Please, Colin.
All right, he said, after a few moments, awed by his own daring. It was a short walk, in the fresh, clean air, each of them clutching their voter registration cards. The church hall was empty of voters apart from themselves. Each put a thick pencil cross beside Colin's name and left with a sense that they had got away with something. Miles Mollison did not vote until midday. He paused at his partner's door on the way out.
I'm off to vote, Gav, he said.
Gavin indicated the telephone pressed against his ear. He was on hold with Mary's insurance company.
Oh. Right, I'm off to vote, Shona, said Miles, turning to their secretary.
There was no harm in reminding them both that he was in need of their support. Miles jogged downstairs and proceeded to the copper kettle, where, during a brief post-coital chat, he had arranged to meet his wife so that they could go down to the church hall together. Samantha had spent the morning at home, leaving her assistant in charge at the shop. She knew that she could no longer put off telling Carly that they were out of business and that Carly was out of a job, but she could not bring herself to do it before the weekend and the concert in London. When Miles appeared and she saw his excited little grin, she experienced a rush of fury.
Dad not coming, were his first words.
They're going down after closing time, said Samantha.
There were two old ladies in the voting booths when she and Miles got there. Samantha waited, looking at the backs of their iron-grey perms, their thick coats and their thicker ankles. That was how she would look one day. The more crooked of the two old women noticed Miles as they left, beamed, and said,
I've just voted for you.
Well, thank you very much, said Miles, delighted.
Samantha entered the booth and stared down at the two names, Miles Mollison and Colin Wall, the pencil tied to the end of a piece of string in her hand. Then she scribbled, I hate bloody Pagford, across the paper, folded it over, crossed to the ballot box and dropped it, unsmiling, through the slot.
Thanks, love, said Miles, quietly, with a pat on her back.
Tessa Wall, who had never failed to vote in an election before, drove past the church hall on her way back home from school and did not stop. Ruth and Simon Price spent the day talking more seriously than ever about the possibility of moving to Reading. Ruth threw out their voter registration cards while clearing the kitchen table for supper. Gavin had never intended to vote. If Barry had been alive to stand, he might have done so, but he had no desire to help Miles achieve another of his life's goals. At 5:30, he packed up his briefcase, irritable and depressed because he had finally run out of excuses not to have dinner at Kay's. It was particularly irksome because there were hopeful signs that the insurance company was shifting in Mary's favour, and he had very much wanted to go over and tell her so. This meant that he would have to store up the news until tomorrow. He did not want to waste it on the telephone. When Kay opened the door to him, she launched at once into the rapid, quick-fire talk that usually meant she was in a bad mood. Sorry, it's been a dreadful day, she said, although he'd not complained, and they had barely exchanged greetings. I was late back. I meant to be further on with dinner. Come through. From upstairs came the insistent crash of drums and a loud bass line. Gavin was surprised that the neighbours were not complaining. Kay saw him glance up at the ceiling and said, Oh, Gaia's furious because some boy she liked back in Hackney has started going out with another girl. She seized the glass of wine she was already drinking and took a big gulp. Her conscience had hurt her when she called Marco De Luca some boy. He had virtually moved into their house in the weeks before they had left London. Kay had found him charming, considerate, and helpful. She would have liked a son like Marco. She'll live, said Kay, pushing the memories away, and she returned to the potatoes she was boiling. She's 16, you bounce at that age. Help yourself to wine. Gavin sat down at the table, wishing that Kay would make Gaia turn the music down. She had virtually to shout at him over the vibration of the bass, the rattling saucepan lids, and the noisy extractor fan. He yearned again for the melancholy calm of Mary's big kitchen, for Mary's gratitude, her need for him. What? He said loudly, because he could tell that Kay had just asked him something. I said, did you vote? Vote? In the council election, she said. No, he replied. Couldn't care less. He was not sure whether she had heard. She was talking again, and only when she turned to the table with knives and forks could he hear her clearly. Absolutely disgusting, actually, that the parish is colluding with Aubrey Fawley. I expect Bellchapel will be finished if Miles gets in. She drained the potatoes, and the splatter and crash drowned her temporarily again. If that silly woman hadn't lost her temper, we might be in with a better shot. I gave her masses of stuff on the clinic, and I don't think she used any of it. She just screamed at Howard Mollison that he was too fat. Talk about unprofessional. Gavin had heard rumours about Dr. Joanda's public outburst. He had found it mildly amusing. All this uncertainty is very damaging to the people who work at that clinic, not to mention the clients. But Gavin could muster neither pity nor indignation. All he felt was dismay at the firm grip Kay seemed to have on the intricacies and personalities involved in this esoteric local issue. It was yet another indication of how she was driving roots deeper and deeper into Pagford. It would take a lot to dislodge her now. He turned his head and gazed out of the window onto the overgrown garden beyond. He had offered to help Fergus with Mary's garden this weekend. With luck, he thought, Mary would invite him to stay for dinner again. And if she did, he would skip Howard Mollison's 65th birthday party, to which Miles seemed to think he was looking forward with excitement.
Wanted to keep the Whedons, but no, Gillian says we can't cherry-pick. Would you call that cherry-picking?
Sorry, what? Asked Gavin.
Matty's back, she said, and he had to struggle to recollect that this was a colleague of hers whose cases she'd been covering. I wanted to keep working with the Whedons because sometimes you do get a particular feeling for a family, but Gillian won't let me. It's crazy.
You must be the only person in the world who ever wanted to keep the Whedons, said Gavin, from what I've heard anyway.
It took nearly all Kay's willpower not to snap at him. She pulled the salmon fillets she'd been baking out of the oven. Gaia's music was so loud that she could feel it vibrating through the tray, which she slammed down on the hob.
Gaia!
She screamed, making Gavin jump as she strode past him to the foot of the stairs.
Gaia! Turn it down! I mean it! Turn it down!
The volume diminished by perhaps a decibel. Kay marched back into the kitchen, fuming. The row with Gaia, before Gavin arrived, had been one of their worst ever. Gaia had stated her intention of telephoning her father and asking to move in with him.
Well, good luck with that, Kay had shouted.
But perhaps Brendan would say yes. He had left her when Gaia was only a month old. Brendan was married now, with three other children. He had a huge house and a good job. What if he said yes? Gavin was glad that he did not have to talk as they ate. The thumping music filled the silence, and he could think about Mary in peace. He would tell her tomorrow that the insurance company was making conciliatory noises and receive her gratitude and admiration. He had almost cleared his plate when he realized that Kay had not eaten a single mouthful. She was staring at him across the table, and her expression alarmed him. Perhaps he had somehow revealed his inner thoughts. Gaia's music came to an abrupt halt overhead. The throbbing quiet was dreadful to Gavin. He wished that Gaia would put something else on quickly.
You don't even try, Kay said miserably. You don't even pretend to care, Gavin.
He attempted to take the easy way out.
Kay, I've had a long day, he said. I'm sorry if I'm not up to the minutiae of local politics the second I walk.
I'm not talking about local politics, she said.
You sit there, looking as if you'd rather be anywhere else. It's offensive. What do you want, Gavin?
He saw Mary's kitchen, her sweet face.
I have to beg to see you, Kay said. And when you come round here, you couldn't make it clearer that you don't want to come.
She wanted him to say, that's not true. The last point at which a denial might have counted slunk past. They were sliding, at increasing speed, towards that crisis which Gavin both urgently desired and dreaded.
Tell me what you want, she said wearily. Just tell me.
Both could feel the relationship crumbling to pieces beneath the weight of everything that Gavin refused to say. It was with a sense of putting them both out of their misery that he reached for words that he had not intended to speak aloud, perhaps ever, but which, in some way, seemed to excuse both of them.
I didn't want this to happen, Gavin said earnestly. I didn't mean it to. Kay, I'm really sorry, but I think I'm in love with Mary Fairbrother.
He saw from her expression that she had not been prepared for this.
Mary Fairbrother, she repeated. I think, he said, and there was a bittersweet pleasure in talking about it, even though he knew he was wounding her. He had not been able to say it to anyone else.
He's been there for a long time. I never acknowledged, I mean, when Barry was alive, I'd never have...
I thought he was your best friend, whispered Kay.
He was.
He's only been dead a few weeks.
Gavin did not like hearing that. Look, he said, I'm trying to be honest with you. I'm trying to be fair.
You're trying to be fair?
He had always imagined it ending in a blaze of fury. but she simply watched him putting on his coat with tears in her eyes. "I'm sorry," he said, and walked out of her house for the last time.
On the pavement, he experienced a rush of elation and hurried to his car. He would be able to tell Mary about the insurance company tonight, after all.
Part 5. Privilege. 7:32. A person who has made a defamatory statement may claim privilege for it if he can show that he made it without malice and in pursuit of a public duty. Charles Arnold Baker, Local Council Administration, 7th edition. 1. Terry Whedon was used to people leaving her. The first and greatest departure had been her mother's, who had never said goodbye, but had simply walked out one day with a suitcase while Terry was at school. There had been lots of social workers and care workers after she ran away at 14, and some of them had been nice enough, but they all left at the end of the working day. Every fresh departure added a fine new layer to the crust building over her core. She had had friends in care, but at 16 they were all on their own, and life had scattered them. She met Richie Adams, and she bore him 2 children. Tiny little pink things, pure and beautiful, like nothing in the whole world. And they had come out of her, and for shining hours in the hospital, twice, it had been like her own rebirth. And then they took the children from her, and she never saw them again, either. Banger had left her. Nana Kath had left her. Nearly everybody went. Hardly anyone stayed. She ought to be used to it by now. When Matty, her regular social worker, reappeared, Terry demanded, "Where's the other one?" "Kay, she was only covering for me while I was ill," said Matty. "So, where's Liam? No, I mean Robbie, don't I?" Terry did not like Matty. For one thing, she did not have kids, and how could people who didn't have kids tell you how to raise them? How could they understand? She had not liked Kay exactly either, except that Kay gave you a funny feeling, the same feeling that Nana Kath had once given Terry, before she had called her a whore and told her that she never wanted to see her again. You felt, with Kay, even though she carried folders, like the rest of them, even though she had instituted the case review, you felt that she wanted things to go right for you, and not only for the forms. You really did feel that. But she was gone. "And she probably don't even think about us now," thought Terry, furiously. On Friday afternoon, Matty told Terry that Bell Chapel would almost certainly close. "It's political," she said briskly. "They want to save money, but methadone treatment's unpopular with the district council. Plus, Pagford wants them out of the building. It was all in the local paper, maybe you saw it." Sometimes she spoke to Terry like that, veering into a kind of, after all, we're in this together small talk that jarred because it sat alongside inquiries as to whether Terry was remembering to feed her son. But this time it was what she said, rather than how she said it, that upset Terry. "They're closing it," she repeated. "It looks that way," said Matty breezily. "But it won't make any difference to you. Well, obviously." 3 times Terry had embarked upon the programme at Bell Chapel. The dusty interior of the converted church with its partition walls and its flyers, the bathroom with its blue light, so you could not find veins and shoot up in there, had become familiar and almost friendly. Lately she had begun to sense in the workers there a change in the way that they spoke to her. They had all expected her to fail again, in the beginning, but they had started talking to her the way Kay had talked, as if they knew a real person lived inside her pockmarked, burned body. "Obviously, it will be different, but you can get your methadone from your GP instead," said Matty. She flipped over pages in the distended file that was the state's record of Terry's life.
You're registered with Dr. Chiwanda in Pagford, right? Pagford, why are you going all the way out there?
I smacked a nurse at Cantermill, said Terry, almost absent-mindedly.
After Matty had left, Terry sat for a long time in her filthy chair in the sitting room, gnawing at her nails until they bled. The moment Crystal came home, bringing Robbie back from nursery, she told her that they were closing Bellchapel.
They ain't decided yet, said Crystal, with authority. The fuck do you know? Demanded Terry. They're closing it, and now they say I've got to go to fucking Pagford to that bitch that killed Nana Caff, but I fucking ain't.
You gotta, said Crystal. Crystal had been like this for days, bossing her mother, acting as though she, Crystal, was the grown-up.
I ain't gonna fucking do anything, said Terry furiously. Cheeky little bitch, she added, for good measure. If you start fucking using again, said Crystal, scarlet in the face, they'll take Robbie away.
He was still holding Crystal's hand and burst into tears.
See?
Both women shouted at each other.
You're fucking doing it to him, shouted Crystal. And anyway, that doctor didn't do nothing to Nana Caff. That's all just Cheryl and them talking shit. Fucking little know-it-all, ain't ya? Yelled Terry. You know fuck all.
Crystal spat at her.
Get the fuck out!
Screamed Terry, and because Crystal was bigger and heavier, she seized a shoe lying on the floor and brandished it.
Get out! I fucking will, yelled Crystal. And I'll take Robbie and all. And you can stay here and fucking screw Obbo and make another one.
She dragged the wailing Robbie out with her before Terry could stop her. Crystal marched him all the way to her usual refuge, forgetting that at this time in the afternoon, Nicky would still be hanging around outside somewhere, not at home. It was Nicky's mum who opened the door, in her Asda uniform. He ain't staying here, she told Crystal firmly, while Robbie whined and tried to pull his hand from Crystal's tight grip. Where's your mum?
Home, said Crystal.
And everything else she wanted to say evaporated in the older woman's stern gaze. So she returned to Foley Road with Robbie, where Terry, bitterly triumphant, grabbed her son's arm, pulled him inside, and blocked Crystal from entering.
Had enough of him already, have you?
Terry jeered over Robbie's wails.
Fuck off!
And she slammed the door. Terry had Robbie sleep beside her on her own mattress that night. She lay awake and thought about how little she needed Crystal and ached for her as badly as she had ever craved smack. Crystal had been angry for days. The thing that Crystal had said about Obbo.
She said what?
He had laughed incredulously when they had met in the street and Terry had muttered something about Crystal being upset. He wouldn't have done it. He couldn't have.
Obbo was one of the few people who had hung around. Terry had known him since she was 15. They had gone to school together, hung out in Yarvel while she was in care, swigged cider together beneath the trees on the footpath that cut its way through the small patch of remaining farmland beside the fields. They had shared their first joint. Crystal had never liked him.
Jealous, thought Terry, watching Robbie sleep in the streetlight pouring through the thin curtains. Just jealous. He's done more for me than anyone, thought Terry defiantly, because when she tallied kindnesses, she subtracted abandonment. Thus, all of Nana Cath's care had been annihilated by her rejection. But Obbo had hidden her once from Richie, the father of her first two children, when she had fled the house barefoot and bleeding. Sometimes he gave her free bags of smack. She saw them as equivalent kindnesses. His refuges were more reliable than the little house in Hope Street that she had once, for three glorious days, thought was home. Crystal did not return on Saturday morning, but that was nothing new. Terry knew she must be at Nicky's. In a rage, because they were low on food and she was out of cigarettes and Robbie was whining for his sister, she stormed into her daughter's room and kicked her clothes around, searching for money or the odd, overlooked fag. Something clattered
as she threw aside Crystal's crumpled old rowing kit, and she saw the little plastic jewellery box upended with the rowing medal that Crystal had won and Tessa Wall's watch lying beneath it. Terry picked up the watch and stared at it. She had never seen it before. She wondered where Crystal had got it. Her first assumption was that Crystal had stolen it, but then she wondered whether she might have been given it by Nana Kath, or even left it in Nana Kath's will. That was a much more troubling thought than the idea of the watch being stolen. The idea of the sneaky little bitch hiding it away, treasuring it, never mentioning it. Terry put the watch inside the pocket of her tracksuit bottoms and bellowed for Robbie to come with her to the shops. It took ages to get him into his shoes, and Terry lost her temper and slapped him. She wished she could go to the shop alone, but the social workers did not like you leaving kids behind in the house, even though you could get things done much quicker without them.
"Where's Crystal?"
wailed Robbie, as she manhandled him out of the door.
"I want Crystal."
"I don't know where the little tart is," snapped Terry, dragging him along the road.
Bobbo was on the corner beside the supermarket, talking to two men. When he saw her, he raised a hand in greeting, and his two companions walked away.
"How's Ter?" he said.
"Na bad,"
she lied.
"Robbie, let go."
He was digging his fingers so tightly into her thin leg that it hurt.
"Listen," said Obbo, "could you keep a bit more stuff for me for a bit?"
"Kind of stuff," said Terry, prizing Robbie off her leg and holding his hand instead.
"Couple of bags of stuff," said Obbo. "Really help me out, Ter."
"How long for?"
"Few days."
"Bring it round this evening, will ya?" Terry thought of Crystal, and what she would say if she knew.
"Yeah, go on then," said Terry.
She remembered something else, and pulled Tessa's watch out of her pocket.
"Gonna sell this, what you reckon?"
"Not bad," said Obbo, weighing it in his hand.
"I'll give you 20 for it. Bring it over tonight."
Terry had thought the watch might be worth more, but she did not like to challenge him.
"Yeah, all right then."
She took a few steps towards the supermarket entrance, hand in hand with Robbie, but then turned abruptly.
"I ain't using, though," she said, "so don't bring..."
"Still on the mixture," he said, grinning at her through his thick glasses.
"Bellchapel's done for, mind. It's all in the paper."
"Yeah," she said miserably, and she tugged Robbie towards the entrance of the supermarket.
"I know. I ain't going to Padford," she thought, as she picked biscuits off the shelf. "I ain't going there."
She was almost inured to constant criticism and assessment, to the sideways glance of passers-by, to abuse from the neighbours, but she was not going to go all the way to that smug little town to get double helpings, to travel back in time once a week to the place where Nana Kath had said she would keep her, but let her go. She would have to pass that pretty little school that had sent horrible letters home about Crystal, saying that her clothes were too small and too dirty, that her behaviour was unacceptable. She was afraid of long-forgotten relatives emerging from Hope Street as they squabbled over Nana Kath's house, and of what Cheryl would say if she knew that Terry had entered into voluntary dealings with the packy bitch who had killed Nana Kath, another mark against her in the family that despised her.
"They ain't making me go to fucking Padford," Terry muttered aloud, pulling Robbie towards the checkout.
2.
"Brace yourself," teased Howard Mollison at midday on Saturday. "Mum's about to post the results on the website. Want to wait and see it made public, or shall I tell you now?"
Miles turned away instinctively from Samantha, who was sitting opposite him at the island in the middle of the kitchen. They were having a last coffee before she and Libby set off for the station and the concert in London. With the handset pressed tightly to his ear, he said,
"Go on." "You won. Comfortably. Pretty much 2-1 over Wall."
Miles grinned at the kitchen door.
"Okay,"
he said, keeping his voice as steady as he could.
Good to know.
Hang on, said Howard. Mum wants a word.
Well done, darling, said Shirley gleefully. Absolutely wonderful news. I knew you'd do it.
Thanks, Mum, said Miles. Those two words told Samantha everything, but she had resolved not to be scornful or sarcastic. Her band's T-shirt was packed, she had had her hair done, and she had bought new heels. She could hardly wait to leave.
Parish Councillor Mollison, then, is it? She said, when he had hung up.
That's right, he said, a little warily.
Congratulations, she said. It's going to be a real celebration tonight, then. I'm sorry I'm missing it, actually, she lied, out of excitement at her imminent escape.
Touched, Miles leaned forward and squeezed her hand.
Libby appeared in the kitchen in tears. She was clutching her mobile in her hand.
What? Said Samantha, startled.
Please will you call Harriet's mum?
Why?
Please will you?
But why, Libby?
Because she wants to talk to you, because...
Libby wiped her eyes and nose on the back of her hand.
Harriet and I have had a big row. Please will you call her?
Samantha took the telephone through to the sitting room. She had only the haziest idea who this woman was. Since the girls had started at boarding school, she had virtually no contact with their friends' parents.
I'm so desperately sorry to do this, said Harriet's mother. I told Harriet I'd speak to you because I've been telling her it's not that Libby doesn't want her to go. You know how close they are, and I hate seeing them like this.
Samantha checked her watch. They needed to leave in 10 minutes at the latest.
Harriet's got it into her head that Libby had a spare ticket, but didn't want to take her. I told her it's not true. You're taking the ticket because you don't want Libby going alone, aren't you?
Well, naturally, said Samantha. She can't go alone.
I knew it, said the other woman. She sounded strangely triumphant. And I absolutely understand your protectiveness, and I would never suggest it if I didn't think it would save you an awful lot of bother. It's just that the girls are so close, and Harriet's absolutely wild about this silly group. And I think, from what Libby's just told Harriet on the phone, that Libby's really desperate for her to go too. I totally understand why you want to keep an eye on Libby, but the thing is, my sister's taking her two girls, so there would be an adult there with them. I could drive Libby and Harriet up together this afternoon. We'd meet up with the others outside the stadium, and we could all stay overnight at my sister's place. I absolutely guarantee that my sister or I will be with Libby at all times.
Oh, that's so kind.
But my friend, said Samantha, with a strange ringing in her ears, is expecting us, you see. But if you still wanted to go and visit your friend, all I'm saying is there's really no need for you to attend, is there, if somebody else is with the girls? And Harriet's absolutely desperate, really desperate. I wasn't going to get involved, but now it's putting a strain on their friendship.
Then, on a less gushing note,
we'd buy the ticket from you, of course.
There was nowhere to go, nowhere to hide.
Oh, said Samantha.
Yes, I just thought it might be nice to go with her. They'd much prefer to be with each other, said Harriet's mother firmly.
And you won't have to crouch down and hide among all the little teeny boppers.
It's all right for my sister. She's only 5'2".
3.
To Gavin's disappointment, it seemed that he would have to attend Howard Mollison's birthday party after all. If Mary, a client of the firm and the widow of his best friend, had asked him to stay for dinner, he would have considered himself more than justified in skipping it. But Mary had not asked him to stay. She had family visiting, and she had been oddly flustered when he had turned up. She doesn't want them to know, he thought, taking comfort in her self-consciousness as she ushered him towards the door. He drove back to the smithy, replaying his conversation with Kay in his mind.
I thought he was your best friend. He's only been dead a few weeks.
Yeah, and I was looking after her for Barry, he retorted in his head, which is what he'd have wanted. Neither of us expected this to happen. Barry's dead. It can't hurt him now. Alone in the smithy, He looked out a clean suit for the party, because the invitation said formal, and tried to imagine gossipy little Pagford relishing the story of Gavin and Mary. So what? He thought, staggered by his own bravery. Is she supposed to be alone forever? It happens. I was looking after her. And in spite of his reluctance to attend a party that was sure to be dull and exhausting, he was buoyed inside by a little bubble of excitement and happiness. Up in Hilltop House, Andrew Price was styling his hair with his mother's blow dryer. He had never looked forward to a disco or a party as much as he had longed for tonight. He, Gaia and Sukhvinder were being paid by Howard to serve food and drinks at the party. Howard had hired him a uniform for the occasion, a white shirt, black trousers and a bow tie. He would be working alongside Gaia, not as potboy, but as a waiter. But there was more to his anticipation than this. Gaia had split up with the legendary Marco De Luca. He had found her crying about it in the backyard of the Copper Kettle that afternoon, when he had gone outside for a smoke. His loss, Andrew had said, trying to keep the delight out of his voice. And she had sniffed and said, "Cheers, Andy." "You little pufter," said Simon, when Andrew finally turned off the dryer. He had been waiting to say it for several minutes, standing on the dark landing, staring through the gap in the door, which was ajar, watching Andrew preen himself in the mirror. Andrew jumped, then laughed. His good humour discomposed Simon. "Look at you," he jeered, as Andrew passed him on the landing in his shirt and bow tie. "With your dicky bow, you look a twat." "And you're unemployed, and I did it to you, dickhead." Andrew's feelings about what he had done to his father changed almost hourly. Sometimes the guilt would bear down on him, tainting everything, but then it would melt away, leaving him glorying in his secret triumph. Tonight, the thought of it gave extra heat to the excitement burning beneath Andrew's thin white shirt, an additional tingle to the goose flesh caused by the rush of evening air as he sped on Simon's racing bike down the hill into town. He was excited, full of hope. Gaia was available and vulnerable. Her father lived in Reading. Shirley Mollison was standing in a party dress outside the church hall when he cycled up, tying giant gold helium balloons in the shapes of fives and sixes to the railings.
"Hello, Andrew," she trilled. "Bike away from the entrance, please."
He wheeled it along to the corner, passing a brand new racing green BMW convertible parked feet away. He walked around the car on his way inside, taking in the luxurious inner fittings.
"And here's Andy."
Andrew saw at once that his boss's good humour and excitement were equal to his own. Howard was striding down the hall, wearing an immense velvet dinner jacket. He resembled a conjurer. There were only five or six other people dotted around. The party would not start for 20 minutes. Blue, white and gold balloons had been fastened up everywhere. There was a massive trestle table largely covered in plates draped with tea towels, and at the top of the hall, a middle-aged DJ setting up his equipment. "Go help Maureen, Andy, will you?" She was laying out glasses at one end of the long table, caught gaudily in a stream of light from an overhead lamp.
"Don't you look handsome?" she croaked as he approached.
She was wearing a scant, stretchy, shiny dress that revealed every contour of the bony body to which unexpected little rolls and pads of flesh still clung, exposed by the unforgiving fabric. From somewhere out of sight came a small, "Hi." Gaia was crouching over a box of plates on the floor.
"Glasses out of boxes, please, Andy," said Maureen, "and set them up here where we're having the bar."
He did as he was told. As he unpacked the box, a woman he'd never seen before approached, carrying several bottles of champagne. "These should go in the fridge if there is one." She had Howard's straight nose, Howard's big blue eyes, and Howard's curly fair hair,
but whereas his features were womanish, softened by fat, his daughter, she had to be his daughter, was unpretty yet striking, with low brows, big eyes, and a cleft chin. She was wearing trousers and an open-necked silk shirt. After dumping the bottles onto the table, she turned away. Her demeanour, and something about the quality of her clothing, made Andrew sure that she was the owner of the BMW outside.
"That's Patricia," whispered Gaia in his ear, and his skin tingled again as though she carried an electric charge. "Howard's daughter."
"Yeah, I thought so," he said. But he was much more interested to see that Gaia was unscrewing the cap of a bottle of vodka and pouring out a measure.
As he watched, she drank it straight off with a little shudder. She had barely replaced the top when Maureen reappeared beside them with an ice bucket.
"Bloody old slapper," said Gaia, as Maureen walked away, and Andrew smelt the spirits on her breath. "Look at the state of her."
He laughed, turned and stopped abruptly because Shirley was right beside them, smiling her pussycat smile.
"Has Miss Chiwanda not arrived yet?"
she asked. "She's on her way. She just texted me," said Gaia. But Shirley did not really care where Sukhvinder was. She'd overheard Andrew and Gaia's little exchange about Maureen, and it had completely restored the good mood that had been dented by Maureen's evident delight in her own toilette. It was difficult to satisfactorily puncture self-esteem so obtuse, so deluded. But as Shirley walked away from the teenagers towards the DJ, she planned what she would say to Howard the next time she saw him alone.
"I'm afraid the young ones were, well, laughing at Maureen. It's such a pity she wore that dress. I hate seeing her make a fool of herself."
There was plenty to be pleased about, Shirley reminded herself, for she needed a little bolstering tonight. She and Howard and Miles were all going to be on the council together. It would be marvellous, simply marvellous. She checked that the DJ knew that Howard's favourite song was the Green, Green Grass of Home, Tom Jones's version, and looked around for more little jobs to do. But instead, her gaze fell upon the reason that her happiness tonight had not quite that perfect quality she had anticipated. Patricia was standing alone, staring up at the Pagford coat of arms on the wall and making no effort to talk to anybody. Shirley wished that Patricia would wear a skirt sometimes. But at least she'd arrived alone. Shirley had been afraid that the BMW might contain another person, and that absence was something gained. You weren't supposed to dislike your own child. You were supposed to like them no matter what, even if they were not what you wanted, even if they turned out to be the kind of person that you would have crossed the street to avoid had you not been related. Howard took a large view of the whole matter. He even joked about it in a mild way beyond Patricia's hearing. Shirley could not rise to those heights of detachment. She felt compelled to join Patricia in the vague, unconscious hope that she might dilute the strangeness she was afraid everyone else would smell by her own exemplary dress and behaviour.
"Do you want a drink, darling?"
"Not yet," said Patricia, still staring up at the Pagford Arms. "I had a heavy night last night. Probably still over the limit. We were out drinking with Melly's office pals." Shirley smiled vaguely up at the crest above them. "Melly's fine, thanks for asking," said Patricia.
"Oh, good,"
said Shirley. "I like the invitation," said Patricia. "Pat and guest."
"I'm sorry, darling, but that's just what you put, you know, when people aren't married."
"Ah, that's what it says in Debrett's, does it? Well, Melly didn't want to come if she wasn't even named on the invitation, so we had a massive row, and here I am, alone. Result, eh?" Patricia stalked away towards the drinks, leaving Shirley a little shaken behind her. Patricia's rages had been frightening even as a child.
"You're late, Miss Chiwanda," she called,
recovering her composure as a flustered Sukhvinder came hurrying towards her. In Shirley's opinion, the girl was demonstrating a kind of insolence turning up at all after what her mother had said to Howard, here,
in this very hall. She watched her hurry to join Andrew and Gaia, and thought that she would tell Howard that they ought to let Sukhvinder go. She was tardy, and there was probably a hygiene issue with the eczema she was hiding under the long-sleeved black T-shirt. Shirley made a mental note to check whether it was contagious on her favourite medical website. Guests began to arrive promptly at 8 o'clock. Howard told Gaia to come and stand beside him and collect coats, because he wanted everyone to see him ordering her around by name in that little black dress and frilly apron. But there were soon too many coats for her to carry alone, so he summoned Andrew to help. "Knicker bottle," Gaia ordered Andrew as they hung coats 3 and 4 deep in the tiny cloakroom, "and hide it in the kitchen. We can take it in turns to go and have some." "Okay," said Andrew, elated.
"Gavin," cried Howard, as his son's partner came through the door alone at 8:30.
"Kay not with you, Gavin?"
asked Shirley swiftly.
Maureen was changing into sparkly stilettos behind the trestle table, so there was very little time to steal a march on her.
"No, she couldn't make it, unfortunately," said Gavin. Then, to his horror, he came face to face with Gaia, who was waiting to take his coat.
"Mum could have made it," said Gaia, in a clear, carrying voice as she glared at him. "But Gavin's dumped her, haven't you, Gav?"
Howard clapped Gavin on the shoulder, pretending he'd not heard, and boomed,
"Great to see you. Go get yourself a drink."
Shirley's expression remained impassive, but the thrill of the moment did not subside quickly, and she was a little dazed and dreamy, greeting the next few guests. When Maureen tottered over in her awful dress to join the greeting party, Shirley took immense pleasure in telling her quietly,
"We've had a very awkward little scene. Very awkward. Gavin and Gaia's mother. Oh dear, if we'd known."
"What? What's happened?"
But Shirley shook her head, savouring the exquisite pleasure of Maureen's frustrated curiosity, and opened her arms wide as Miles, Samantha and Lexi entered the hall.
"Here he is, Parish Councillor Miles Mollison."
Samantha watched Shirley hugging Miles as though from a great distance. She had moved so abruptly from happiness and anticipation to shock and disappointment that her thoughts had become white noise against which she had to fight to take in the exterior world. Miles had said,
"That's great, you can come to Dad's party, you were only just saying."
"Yes," she had replied, "I know. It is great, isn't it?"
But when he had seen her dressed in the jeans and band T-shirt she had been visualizing herself in for over a week, he had been perplexed.
"It's formal."
"Miles, it's the church hall in Pagford."
"I know, but the invitation..."
"I'm wearing this."
"Hello, Sammy," said Howard. "Look at you. You needn't have dressed up."
But his embrace was as lascivious as ever, and he patted her tightly jeaned backside. Samantha gave Shirley a cold, tight smile and walked past her towards the drinks. A nasty voice inside her head was asking,
"But what did you think was going to happen at the concert anyway? What was the point? What were you after?"
"Nothing. Bit of fun."
The dream of strong young arms and laughter, which was to have had some kind of catharsis tonight. Her own thin waist encircled again, and the sharp taste of the new, the unexplored. Her fantasy had lost wings. It was plummeting back to earth.
"I only wanted to look."
"Looking good, Sammy.
Cheers, Pat."
She'd not met her sister-in-law for over a year.
"I like you more than anyone else in this family, Pat."
Miles had caught up with her. He kissed his sister.
"How are you? How's Mel? Isn't she here?"
"No, she didn't want to come," said Patricia. She was drinking champagne, but from her expression it might have been vinegar. "The invitation said Pat and guest are invited. Huge bloody row, one up to Mum."
"Oh, Pat, come on," said Miles, smiling.
"Oh, Pat, fucking come on what, Miles?" A furious delight took hold of Samantha, a a pretext to attack. That's a bloody rude way to invite your sister's partner, and you know it, Miles. Your mother could do with some lessons in manners, if you ask me. He was fatter, surely, than he had been a year ago. She could see his neck bulging over the collar of his shirt. His breath went sour quickly. He had a little trick of bouncing on his toes that he had caught from his father. She experienced a surge of physical disgust and walked away to the end of the trestle table, where Andrew and Sukhvinder were busy filling and handing out glasses. "Have you got any gin?" Samantha asked. "Give me a big one." She barely recognized Andrew. He poured her a measure, trying not to look at her breasts, boundlessly exposed in the T-shirt, but it was like trying not to squint in direct sunlight. "Do you know them?" Samantha asked, after downing half a glass of gin and tonic. A blush had risen before Andrew could marshal his thoughts. To his horror, she gave a reckless cackle and said, "The band! I'm talking about the band!"
Yeah, I've heard of them. I don't... not my kind of thing."
"Is that right?" she said, throwing back the rest of her drink. "I'll have another one of those, please."
She realized who he was, the mousy boy from the delicatessen. His uniform made him look older. Maybe a couple of weeks of lugging pallets up and down the cellar steps had built some muscle. "Oh, look," said Samantha, spotting a figure heading away from her into the growing crowd. "There's Gavin, the second most boring man in Pagford, after my husband, obviously." She strode off, pleased with herself, holding her new drink. The gin had hit her where she most needed it, anaesthetizing and stimulating at the same time. And as she walked, she thought, "He liked my tits. Let's see what he thinks of my arse." Gavin saw Samantha coming and tried to deflect her by joining somebody else's conversation. Anybody's. The nearest person was Howard, and he insinuated himself hastily into the group around his host.
"I took a risk," Howard was saying to three other men. He was waving a cigar, and a little ash had dribbled down the front of his velvet jacket. "I took a risk and I put in the graft, simple as that. No magic formula. Nobody handed me a... Oh, here's Sammy. Who were those young men, Samantha?"
While four elderly men stared at the pop group stretched across her breasts, Samantha turned to Gavin.
"Hi,"
she said, leaning in and forcing him to kiss her.
"Kay not here?"
"No," said Gavin shortly.
"Talking about business, Sammy," said Howard happily, and Samantha thought of her shop, failed and finished. "I was a self-starter," he informed the group, reprising what was clearly an established theme. "That's all there is to it. That's all you need. I was a self-starter."
Massive and globular, he was like a miniature velvety sun, radiating satisfaction and contentment. His tones were already rounded and mellowed by the brandy in his hand.
"I was ready to take a risk. Could have lost everything."
"Well, your mum could have lost everything," Samantha corrected him. "Didn't Hilda mortgage her house to put up half the deposit on the shop?" She saw the tiny flicker in Howard's eyes, but his smile remained constant.
"All credit to my mother, then," he said, "for working and scrimping and saving and giving her son a start. I multiply what I was given, and I give back to the family. Pay for your girls to go to St. Anne's. What goes round comes round, eh, Sammy?"
She expected this from Shirley, but not from Howard. Both of them drained their glasses, and Samantha watched Gavin drift away without trying to stop him. Gavin was wondering whether it would be possible to slip out unnoticed. He was nervous, and the noise was making it worse. A horrible idea had taken possession of him since meeting Gaia at the door. What if Kay had told her daughter everything? What if the girl knew that he was in love with Mary Fairbrother and told other people? It was the sort of thing that a vengeful 16-year-old might do. The very last thing he wanted was for Pagford to know that he was in love with Mary before he'd had a chance to tell her himself. He'd imagined doing it months and months hence, perhaps a year down the line,
letting the first anniversary of Barry's death slip by, and in the meantime nurturing the tiny shoots of